Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. The podcast series you are about to hear befell listeners of a program known as Parallax Views, hosted and produced by J.G. Michael, who the recently arrested John McAfee once speculated was an extraterrestrial Gorgon, devised a series of episodes to be produced and published over the course of a two-week period leading up to Halloween 2020. The result of those recordings led to one of the most bizarre auditory experiences in podcasting history, the Halloween Podcast Massacre.
Southern New Jersey's Pine Barrens. It's named for the unusual pine forest that grows miraculously on a barren plain of sandy, acidic soil. Coupled with this curiosity is the hideous monster that supposedly haunts these woods, the Jersey Devil. Over the past 300 years, witnesses, too numerous to count, swear they've seen the mythical creature.
In colonial days, if a well went dry or hens didn't lay or milk went sour, they always blamed it on the Jersey Devil. Even larger things were blamed, like failure of crops.
The biggest outbreak of the Jersey Devil sightings was in 1909, when like almost everybody in South Jersey saw it.
There were many front page newspaper articles written about this. Posses were sent out. Children were kept indoors. Schools were closed. Factories were closed because of this one notorious week.
Cops to mayors, I mean, you know, legitimate people saw this thing flying, and it's all described the same way.
It has the bony head of a horse,
the wings of a bat,
bright red, piercing, evil eyes.
It's a mixture, a mishmash of different animal characteristics, very unexpected. There's really nothing in the natural world that contains all of these different characteristics.
That's right. It's another edition of the Parallax Views Halloween Podcast Massacre. And since it's Devil's Night, I thought what better way to celebrate the day before Halloween than to discuss the Jersey Devil. The winged monster with the head of a camel or maybe a horse that terrorizes and stalks the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. Well, the actual story behind the myth may prove even more interesting, which is why I've recruited historian Brian Regal, co-author with Frank J. Esposito of The Secret History of the Jersey Devil, How Quakers, Hucksters, and Benjamin Franklin Created a Monster, to tell us how the beast of the Pine Barrens became a part of American folklore. Believe it or not, the true story doesn't involve a winged creature haunting the Pine Barrens, but instead religious bigotry, bare knuckles, political mudslinging, and fake news in early America. Sound familiar? The more things change, the more they stay the same. Oh, and yes, we do get into how the founding father, Benjamin Franklin, ties in to the story. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to my conversation with Brian Regal, co-author of The Secret History of the Jersey Devil: How Quakers, Hucksters, and Benjamin Franklin Created a Monster. Welcome to Parallax Views, Professor Brian Regal, co-author with Frank J. Esposito of the fascinating book, The Secret History of the Jersey Devil: How Quakers, Hucksters, and Benjamin Franklin Created a Monster. I'm so glad I could get you on the show before Devil's Night, because I thought, what a perfect show to have for Devil's Night than to talk about the actual origins of the Jersey Devil myth, a bit of folklore.
Thanks. Well, thanks for having me on.
So, Brian, I want to get into the book, The Secret History of the Jersey Devil. But first, you've written on a number of different topics that are sort of seen as being on the fringe or the weird end of history. You yourself openly say you don't believe in things like Bigfoot or UFOs. Right. But I find it interesting.
Never seen anybody spontaneously combust.
Well, you've written about, the occultist Montag Summers. You've written about one of the few, I think, academically trained Bigfoot researchers, Grover Krantz. And of course, you've written about the Jersey Devil. And it's sort of from this perspective of a historian. Why, though? Because a lot of people may find that even weirder than someone who just believes in the monsters. Why write books that, I don't know if it's debunking in the normal sense, but trying to uncover what is behind these stories?
Yeah, well, I don't consider myself a debunker. The Wall Street Journal called me a debunker once, but I don't. That's not the way I approach this. I'm a historian, and so I go out and I approach these topics from the standpoint of a historian. My formal academic training is in modern history and literature with a specialty in the history of science. And what I always tell people is I can explain to you how evolution works. I can explain to you why vaccinations are good for you. I can explain why climate change is real. And I can do it all while quoting the romantic poets. That's my area. I did my doctoral dissertation on this very interesting guy from the late 19th, early 20th century, Henry Fairfield Osborne, who ran the American Museum of Natural History for a long time. I mean, he practically died literally in his office. But he's a fascinating character because he sort of breaks, what drew me to him was he breaks that mold that we seem to have today where if you are a religious person, you're not allowed to believe in evolution and science. If you're a believer in science and evolution, you must hate God. And Osborne threw that whole thing, on its head. He was a deeply religious guy. By our standards today, we'd call him a fundamentalist. But he was also, he was a very public scientist. He was also a powerful advocate for teaching science and evolution in public schools, that the higher the nation's scientific literacy was, the freer we would be, the more successful we would be. And so that's sort of what drew me to him. And I was working on this relationship of science and evolution. I once went to a creationist conference down at Liberty University in 2005, which was interesting, to say the least. And
were any of the usual suspects there, like Dr. Dino Kent Hovind or any people like that?
Yeah, all the guys were there. They had all these panels about, why radiocarbon dating doesn't work and why fossils lie and all that kind of thing. But they picked me out of the crowd immediately as an interloper. So, I've worked in this area of the relationship between politics and science and religion. And I think one of the things that kind of links all the stuff together that I've done, all these books and articles, is I'm fascinated by the relationship between professional scholars and amateur enthusiasts, and how they relate to one another. And, you know, the book on Sasquatch is basically a biography of Grover Krantz, but I used Krantz as a vehicle to look at this relationship between professional scientists who didn't think Bigfoot was real and amateur investigators who, you know, passionately believed that it was. And that's also the way we approach, Frank Esposito and I approached the Jersey Devil, from this notion of this kind of dichotomy between professionals and amateurs.
Yeah, it's interesting because the impression I get from your work is actually that you are sympathetic in a way, at least towards the personalities. When it comes to these monster hunters, it's easy to sort of just, you know, laugh and say, oh, what gullible or strange people. Right. But I mean, mm-hmm. to write about these topics themselves, even from that skeptical perspective, probably comes off as strange to some people because they'll say, well, why are you even giving these people the time of day? In a way, I think what you're doing is kind of almost giving them their sort of moment in the limelight, even if you are saying, oh, there isn't a Jersey Devil. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, what part of the other thing that kind of attracts me to these worlds is I'm a sucker for tragic characters. There's historians and historians of science in particular, we have a tendency to focus on those people and those ideas which, for lack of a better term, and I've been doing this for years, I'm still not really quite sure what term to use here, but for lack of a better expression, successful science stories, where groups and individuals and institutions, they fight for something they think is important to bring that information to the public and to make it known. But eventually what happens is no matter how much difficulty they run into, eventually they prove their point. You know, Edward Jenner proved vaccinations were real. Darwin eventually proved evolution was a thing that really went on. You know, so these are these kind of winner stories. What part of the reason I didn't go that route with my career was, first off, there's lots of really fantastic historians out there who are already working on this. I mean, how am I ever going to come up with something new about Darwin? There are so many great people out there doing the history of science that really are just super top-notch scholars. And when I was beginning this sort of thing, I said, well, how am I going to compete with that? They're already, this material is already being covered by minds far sharper than my own. And then I started discovering these monster hunters and ghost hunters and all of that, which I had actually sort of discovered as a kid, but kind of lost track of as time went by until I kind of went back to them.
Did you watch Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of, I take it?
Oh, of course. Nobody my age, nobody from my generation who is interested in this sort of material cannot tell you that when I saw Leonard Nimoy talk about this on In Search Of, that fired my imagination. I would be hard pressed to be able to point to somebody who doesn't say that, who wouldn't say that was sort of my first experience with this. And so I was fascinated by the idea of, we know that we learn a lot from winners. You know, we can learn a lot from how diseases were fought, how surgery was improved, and how we discovered that the earth went around the sun and all that sort of thing. These are sort of, we learn from that. That's how our universe works. That's how the cosmos works. And people at the other end of that spectrum, the ones that I'm most interested in. And again, I've been doing this for years, and I'm not really quite sure the right words to use here, but people who are not successful, who do chase these dreams their whole careers, their whole lives, and at the end, they've got nothing. We still, I think, can learn from them. I think we can learn as much from losers as we can learn from winners. And one of the things that occurred to me when I first sort of started turning my attention seriously to these areas was that there really wasn't that much out there by, you know, trained academic scholars. Lots of stuff by amateurs, lots of stuff by true believers, but not that much. You know, you have a few scientists here and there who sort of address these issues, but almost nothing from a historical point of view. When Frank and I did our book on the Jersey Devil, there was really just one other book that had come out a little bit before ours, that was of any value. And that was written by a really terrific New Jersey journalist. But his book was mostly a kind of personal memoir where he talks about how his grandmother told him as a child that he was related to the Jersey Devil. And so his book is kind of it's called, and now the name just flew right out of my head. Maybe we can attach it to the video when we're done. But he sort of goes on this adventure to try to find out in a kind of tongue-in-cheek sort of way. But other than that, there really was nothing. There were a couple of books that were written by people who should have known better, whose names I won't say, who basically thought the Jersey Devil and Bigfoot were real. And they basically went around collecting up all these old stories and kind of screw them together and say, oh, look at all these stories. All these people can't be wrong. There must be a Jersey Devil. There must be a Bigfoot. And so when Frank and I decided to get into this and actually engage with this, because what most people don't realize about how historians work, it takes a long time to write a book. You know, we went to archives and archives over and over again. It took me 4 years to write the Krantz biography. It took us about 4 years to write the Jersey Devil book, because we can't just make stuff up. Historians can't just pull, you know, some bits and pieces off Wikipedia and say, oh, I've got a new book where I prove that, you know, aliens are real or something. We have to go to the archives. We have to track down documents. We have to dig through the dusty back, you know, alleys of libraries and, you know, people's attics where they keep old books and newspapers and things. And that's how history is done. It's not, you know, I tell my students, my history majors, I say, you know, I love being a historian. It's fun. It's exciting. You get to battle with evildoers, especially in the 21st century. But a lot of the work is just this kind of slow grind through mountains and mountains of paperwork, finding the names, finding the little bits of information, collating all the stuff together to get a bigger picture. And it's not something you do over a weekend. But I find it hugely fascinating and quite frankly, a lot of fun. And so that's how we do this thing. And so that's what Frank and I decided to do. Let's tackle this problem the way we would tackle any other historical problem. And so we just started going out and figuring out what archives to look at, what libraries had things, and to go through all the material. I mean, we traveled to archives from Boston to Washington. I went to London to a couple of archives and libraries over there to find stuff that wasn't here in the States. And slowly but surely, you sort of begin to build this picture based upon facts and evidence. And that's how, you know, we started this thing. We thought, well, obviously there isn't actually a monster running around the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. We sort of started from that position, that's not a thing. But then we started asking questions. Well, what might account for this? And so we started asking questions like, well, maybe there was a monstrous birth somewhere in the region at the time that people didn't know how to interpret, because that sort of thing happened in Europe quite a bit. And then we began realizing that this is not a monster story in the flesh and blood biological sense. This is a political story. The Jersey Devil is a political animal. It starts off as the Leeds Devil, but the notion of connecting this story, this mythology, to a flesh and blood animal actually comes very late in the game, literally not until the 20th century. I mean, late 19th, early 20th century, do we really start connecting a biological entity or a supposed biological entity with this story. And what we discovered was that, you know, this is a story which is far more interesting, far more exciting, and a far more important historical story than, you know, some lame, emaciated flying horse wandering around the Pine Barrens.
I actually wanted to get into that because I may have a listener or two that hasn't seen, I mean, I'm assuming most people have seen the countless television shows like Monster Trek or whatever that cover the Jersey Devil, or they're thinking either that or they're thinking we're talking about the hockey team, but the Jersey Devil myth, right? Maybe you could describe the myth and also a description. Let's start with a description of what the supposed monster looks like. I've heard horse head, although I always thought it was like a weird camel-headed creature.
Well, you know, camel head is as good as anything else. What I always tell people is imagine Pegasus at the end of a really bad meth addiction. You know, broken down, skinny, holes in its wings, you know, the kind of horsey, maybe claws on the front and hooves on the back, you know, with a point on it.
I was going to say real quick, it seems like the most anatomically incorrect and bizarre of any, you know, cryptid or monster that people about.
Yeah, if you know anything about biology or zoology or even evolution, it's a preposterously improbable animal. There are no, you know, wings are limbs. That's why, you know, birds, for example, don't have arms. They have wings. They have wings and they have legs. And mammals don't have wings. We have arms. And so for an animal to have both legs, arms, and wings means they are six-armed, which means if you know anything about mammal anatomy, that would mean you have to have two sets of shoulder blades, two rib cages. And if you've got two rib cages, what do you put in the second rib cage? Is it empty? Does that mean you have two hearts? You know, it's the same problem you have with a centaur. There's a lot of extra parts moving around in there that nobody can ever seem to explain, you know, why that would be. And so from a strictly biological point of view, it's really an improbable animal.
Now the legend itself, I don't know if you can, reiterate it for people that aren't familiar, because it actually makes a good, you know, horror movie type tale or campfire story.
Yeah. Well, I can give you the fast, you know, the down and dirty 30-second, story. So, now, keep in mind, there are variants on all this, but let me just give you the stripped-down basic model here. 1735, deep in the wilds of the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. And for those of you who have no idea what New Jersey looks like, people always, you know, I've lectured about this stuff all around the world, and when people think of New Jersey, they think of Springsteen, they think of The Sopranos. They think of that last 15 miles of the turnpike, you know, where the oil refineries and the highways and all, you know, Newark, Elizabeth, Kearney, Bergen County. But what most people who aren't really familiar with it don't know is that sort of the lower half of New Jersey is a huge pine forest that looks almost nothing like the northern part of New Jersey. It's almost two states. In fact, for a while, it was basically two colonies. And so anyway, so down there in the Pine Barrens, a woman named Mother Leeds has a child, which of course is the 13th child, because, you know, you can't have a good adult, a cult offspring, unless it's the 13th. And instead of a normal child coming out, it's this sort of abomination with wings and, you know, horns and stuff, very unhuman-like. And it sort of screams at the astonished family and midwife who are sitting there. And then rather than go out the front door, for some reason, it climbs into the chimney and goes out the fireplace, and then disappears off into the woods for the next couple, two, three centuries, accosting, you know, innocent passersby. And that's the basic story.
So going from the Jersey Devil, we have to trace back a lot in time to get the story of the Leeds Devil, which eventually leads us to the formation of the Jersey Devil myth. In order to do that, maybe you can give my listeners an idea of the time that our sort of main character, Daniel Leeds, sort of lived through in American history. It's a very unusual time. I don't think people realize that early America, you know, there was a lot of strange beliefs that people had. It was a time of bigotry, you know, anti-Catholic sentiment was huge. There was a lot going on that is very different from how our culture is today, maybe. Although there's similarities too, but go on.
Yeah, part of the thing that we argued was that all this kind of political shenanigans going on now, as awful as it is, it's not that new in the American experience. This goes back to in U.S. history before there was a U.S. You know, the first part of this story takes place. There is no United States yet, and so. Basically, we're talking the end of the 1600s into the 1700s in colonial America, in the kind of region between New York and Philadelphia, though when this story begins, there's no Philadelphia yet either. And so you have the hero of our story, Daniel Leeds. He's a Quaker from England. He's born and raised in England. And he's a Quaker, and at the time in England, the Quakers are undergoing a period of oppression, thanks in large part to the Puritans. The Protestant Reformation has occurred, and Catholicism in England is on the downside for a while. It'll come back up again, and back and forth, especially with the Tudors, and the Puritans are oppressing the Quakers because the Quakers do not believe in political hierarchies. They believe in equality for men and women, and, you know, which flies in the face of everything the Puritans love, a preacher dominated society where women are quiet and, you know, keep their place. They don't care that much for people of color. They really don't like women all that much. They hate anybody who is, you know, what they consider heretics. And they consider the Quakers heretics. Although these labels are a bit not exactly accurate, but if we want to sort of use modern terms, the Puritans are more like the conservatives end of the political spectrum, where the Quakers are more the liberal end, the left wing of the political spectrum.
Yeah, and a lot of Quakers were, not to interrupt you, but a lot of Quakers were also like, pacifists, right? I know General Sedley Butler.
They were Quaker. They sort of, the abolition movement in America is initially a Quaker thing. It's a Quaker movement. Ben Franklin famously is a Quaker, and he starts the first abolition society in America. And so Quakers start leaving England to find some place where they, you know, aren't getting taken advantage of by the Puritans, and they wind up at first going to Boston, but all they do is they run right into a giant population of Puritans in Boston, right around the time of the Salem witch trials. And so they've already been persecuted. Several Quakers have already been burned in England for being Quakers. And so they realize they can't hang around Boston. And they decide, well, you know, we hear about there's this sort of tracts of land down south of here, along a river that will eventually be called the Delaware. And maybe we'll go there. We hear that there's lots of space, not many people. The native people, the Lenni Lenapes, are sort of, you know, nice. And if you treat them well, they'll treat you well. And so we'll head down there. And so Quakers start moving into this region, which is called West Jersey. There's West Jersey and East Jersey. The part of what will eventually be the state that kind of borders along the Hudson River and New York, that's East Jersey. And then the more southerly part that borders along the Delaware River, that's West Jersey. And that's where the Quakers are going to go, West Jersey. And they get a boat, they come across, and they, you know, by then people know enough about the coastline of British North America that they know there's a big bay down there. You can enter the bay straight from the ocean and head up the Delaware River. And so they decide what we're going to do is we're going to take our boat and we're going to get into the Delaware River and we're going to make it go as fast as we can, as far north as we can. And wherever we run aground, that's where we're going to stop. And that's what they do. The ship called the Shield, they get up, you know, and they run it into the shoreline and they get out and they say, well, here we are. This is where we're going to start. And they begin to construct the town of Burlington, which is still there. You can still go to see the original Quaker meeting house. It's still there. Magnificent architecture. They're very nice. They'll let you go in and look around. And there are names and initials carved into the pews, you know, all of which goes back to this period. Part of this building was probably made of wood cannibalized from the Shield. So there's this really deep sense of history in here. And so they start building this Quaker community. And not long after that, along comes a guy named Daniel Eads. And he's about 25 or so. And he decides he's going to go hook up with the Quakers here in Burlington. But he comes with a plan. He is, you see, you can't at the time in England, you couldn't go to university unless you were an Anglican and you had to sign a document saying, I swear to be an Anglican. And if you couldn't go to Oxford or Cambridge unless you did that. And the Quakers would not sign documents like that. And so they couldn't go to university. And so what happens is the Quaker community starts to build this kind of sort of private tutorial system where they get books and they exchange them and they teach each other. And so this is Daniel Leeds' education. And he's a really bright guy. He reads books on astronomy and astrology and alchemy and chemistry and history and literature. He's just, he's an autodidact, just sucking up, you know, knowledge wherever he can get it. And he decides that his contribution to his community will be to bring the ideas of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, which is only just starting to get going, to what at the time is basically the frontier of the empire. Here in New Jersey, we don't think of it that way, you know, because we got cities and, you know, when we think of the frontier, we think of the Western Plains states like Oklahoma and, you know, Kansas and all those. But at the time in the 1600s, New Jersey was the edge of the empire. And, you know, you could throw a rock and be in another world, literally, that you might as well be on the moon. Here we have the Watchung Mountains here in New Jersey. And, people drive through it. I drive through it on a daily basis. And very few people realize that this was once, you know, when you got to the top of the Watchung Mountains and you looked over, you were basically looking off into infinity. And so he's going to bring what he thinks is science and philosophy and theology to the wilderness.
I was going to say, Daniel Leeds himself may come off as a little odd to people in his time, not only because he's writing this almanac and he believes in astrology, which we'll get into, but he also, I guess, has a stutter, which at that time was sort of considered, you know, a deformity.
Yeah, he has a stutter, which he eventually, as an adult, he finally kind of, according to him, he finally sort of conquers. But yeah, he was aware of, or at least sensitive to this notion. One of his sort of scientific heroes is Francis Bacon, and Bacon puts out a book in which he includes writings from other people, and there's a part where Bacon goes on about deformity, and how, you know, people who are deformed, and remember the they're using the term deformed to be, you know, like if you stuttered, you're deformed. You know, not quite the way we think of deformity today, but for them, anything that wasn't exactly, you know, perfect, you were deformed, you were a monster. And so he's kind of sensitive to all of that. And so, you know, people will start, he starts to feel like people are looking at him in that way.
So in regards to Leeds himself, how does he go about creating his almanac, and what is his interest in astrology? How does it all tie together?
Well, one of the things he decides to do when he gets here, he gets this idea, almanacs, that's the way to go. They're relatively easy to produce and relatively inexpensive to produce and to sell. The problem is, in the, you know, the 1660s, 1670s, there are only a few printing presses in all of North America. There's a few of them in Boston. There's one or two of them in New York. There's nothing south of New York. And so you can have all the great ideas you want, but if you can't start physically manufacturing these things, all you have is an idea. But one of those sort of moments of cosmic fate steps in, and a printer named William Bradford shows up in Burlington. Now, if you know anything about the history of printing in America, William Bradford, an important early printer, he's got a printing press with him. There's some question about where he actually first sets up his printing press. He becomes most famous as a Philadelphia printer because it's around the time that Leeds shows up that the settlement that will be Philadelphia just begins to grow. So when Bradford comes along, I think he sets his printing press up first in Burlington. And there's some sort of circumstantial evidence that suggests that. But anyway, Leeds meets Bradford and they kind of hit it off. They become friends. And Leeds says, I got this idea. And Bradford says, I got a printing press. And so, you know, bada boom, bada bing, bada bam, they crank out the very first, the second almanac south of New York. There was an almanac printed shortly before that, but that one doesn't really take off, and it gets, you know, it disappears, and the copies get burned. And so Leeds makes his almanac. It's a one page, what we call a broadsheet. It is a page about yay big, printed only on one side. And he's really proud of it. He puts a lot of effort into it. He includes a material that's typical for an almanac of that period. It's a lot of astrological stuff because almanacs were meant for agricultural communities. And so what they were meant to do was to be able to show farmers when to plant, when to harvest, when winter would begin, when the rainy season was going to begin. So all the stuff that was crucial to successful farming, because remember, again, we're out at the edge of the empire. And if you have a bad crop, you're dead. You know, there's no going to there's no going down the street to the farmer's market to buy, you know, to go to a restaurant to get food. If your garden doesn't fail, if your garden fails, you really don't have much choice in the matter. So this is important information. This is survival information. He produces this first almanac, and he thinks people are going to love this. I'm going to be doing this useful thing, this useful service for my community. And the town fathers, the Quaker town fathers, have the exact opposite reaction that he had hoped for. Not only do they not like it, they think it's too occult, but they go through all the trouble to round up all the copies they can get their hands on and destroy them. They burn them. And so they, you know, they eliminate it to the point where there, to this day, there are, you know, less than a handful of these original almanacs still surviving. I had to go all the way to London to see the one that they had at the British Library. So this today is an extremely rare document, that only a few, there's about maybe two or three full surviving versions and a couple of bits and pieces of fragments. And so that's how he starts off.
Now, a few things to note here, and then we can move into the feud that Daniel Eads has with the Quaker community. And he himself is a Quaker, we should note. But, you know, Bradford himself, I think, had issues with the Quaker elders even before this almanac, almost like that's a bad omen of things to come.
Sure.
And Leeds also, I believe, wrote about things like angels and demons. But what's important to note for my listeners is that even Christians during this time, in private, were entertained by things like ghost stories and stories of angels and demons. So it wasn't necessarily completely off the wall for Leeds to have an interest in these things. But what leads to the big feud between the Quakers and Daniel Eads? Why are they so aggravated by this almanac?
Well, they don't like the first almanac because they think it's too occult, because he used occult symbols, and you know, which was fairly common for almanacs of that time. And the Quakers had this thing where if the community thought you had done something inappropriate, you would have to come and stand before the meeting. They didn't call it church. They called it the meeting. And you would have to get up in front of the meeting and they would say, we think you were, you know, doing this thing which was inappropriate. What do you have to say for yourself? And you would basically have to publicly apologize or you'd be run out of the community. And so they make him do that. And so he does. He apologizes, but it leaves a really bad taste in his mouth because he had sort of thrown all of himself into the Quaker religion. He thought he had found a family within the Quaker religion. His mother dies right before they come over, and she's buried in London. She dies of smallpox. And so he was really shocked and really hurt by this. And so he thinks about it for a while, and he says, okay, maybe I just went about this the wrong way. And he sits down and he writes a book. The Temple of Wisdom for the Little World. And much like his hero Bacon, a lot of it is his own writing. Other parts of it he copies from other books that he thinks are important. This was something that was fairly common at the time, called place booking, where you would, if you sort of aspired to kind of an intellectual life, you would keep a journal. And in addition to writing in your own thoughts and ideas, if you saw something in a book that you really liked, that was inspirational to you, you'd tear it out and stick it into your own, you know, you would build up these kind of scrapbooks of information that you would then go back and read and be inspired by. When Thomas Jefferson, for example, puts together his famous Jefferson Bible, that's what he does. He takes a copy of the King James Bible. He physically chops out all the stuff he thinks is nonsense, and he starts filling it back in with pages taken out of Confucius and the Quran and, you know, of various different philosophers. And, you know, so this was a fairly common place booking was a fairly common thing. And Bradford publishes it, prints it. It's his first book. It's the first book published south of New York in American history. And the Quaker elders hate this thing even more than they hated the almanac. And they go on a spree to destroy all the copies of this thing as well. In fact, we only know of one existing copy of the Temple of Wisdom, and that's in the Pennsylvania Historical Society in Philadelphia. And so that sort of pushes him over the edge. And he says to himself, okay, you're going to treat me like this? And in several Quaker meetings, because of his publications, several Quaker members of, you know, some town fathers start referring to him as being evil for doing this.
Satan's harbinger, right?
Says, you want to take the gloves off? Let's take the gloves off. And so he starts this whole adventure, Daniel Eads does, with this kind of fantasy in his head that he'll become like this wise old owl, sage, that will be seen by his neighbors as a philosopher and, someone you could go to for intellectual advice. And he now realizes that's not going to happen. And so instead, he decides to become a political attack dog. And he starts publishing more books. He starts publishing the Almanac again. And this time he says, I don't care what you say. I'm going to keep publishing this. And I'm going to use every opportunity I can to degrade the Quakers, to, you know, to show them up for the hypocrites he thought that they were. And it gets so bad that the Quakers start publishing anti-Daniel Leeds books, including one by a guy named Pusey, who is a Quaker apologist who publishes a book in which, in print, he says that Daniel Leeds is Satan's harbinger. Now, for us today, that doesn't sound like much of an insult. It's almost adorable. You know, it's almost fun. You know, I've been called, you know, some pretty weird stuff online, and some of it, it's like, you know, that's the funniest thing anyone's ever called me. You know, but to them, this was a serious thing, to be called Satan's harbinger. And so that sort of kicks off this tennis match, if you will. Leeds publishes an anti-Quaker book. The Quakers publish an anti-Leeds book, and back and forth and back and forth we go. And along the way, he's publishing the Almanac, which he is now using as yet another vehicle to get his ideas out, along with all this other material, the fighting with the Quakers. He's the first person to say in print in North America that the Earth goes around the sun. You know, this takes the heliocentric view of the universe, which was not widely accepted yet. Isaac Newton's book, The Principia, has only just been published. You know, this too is a brand new thing. And so, you know, he's out there on the edge intellectually. And he fights for public education. At one point, he publishes this kind of op-ed piece, what we would call an op-ed piece, where he says, you know, my neighbors, all you do is you go out and you drink and you smoke. You should be spending that smoking and drinking money on building your own private library. You know, so he becomes this kind of, you know, angry guy who is, you know, telling his neighbors, his Quaker neighbors, you know, there's more to life than this. Get, you know, study history, study literature. And you know, this is what he's now going to spend the rest of his life doing.
It's interesting because that goes back to what you were saying. We think today's mudslinging over politics and culture is bad, but you know, it's always been with us in a lot of ways.
This was bare knuckle political fighting, you know, to give anything we do today a run for its money. Scandal literature, a political attack literature where you make up lies about your political enemies and you claim. I was watching the thing about Giuliani and the laptop that suddenly materialized. I mean, that was going on at this period when we talk about Lord Cornbury. You know, oh, we just found this information that proves that Lord Cornbury is a crossdresser. You know, so this is really an old story in American history.
And for my listeners, Lord Cornbury actually connects to Daniel Leeds.
Yes, Lord Cornbury, William Hyde was his actual name. He's the first royal governor. This is 1701, 1702. He's the first royal governor of New Jersey. Up until this time, the Jerseys, as they were called, plural, you had East and West Jersey. And then eventually 1700, 1701, the crown screws the two halves together and says, okay, this is going to be one royal colony, New Jersey, named after, the home of a guy named Carteret. There's a city here in New Jersey called Carteret, who grows up on the island of Jersey in the English Channel. And he gets favor from Charles II. And so he gets given this land, and that's why it's called New Jersey. And so the crown takes it over, makes it a royal colony, and Edward Hyde, Lord Cornbury, he's the first governor of New Jersey. And at the same time, governor of New York as well. And he is, to be perfectly honest, is not the sharpest tool in the box, if you will. He was roundly reviled and roundly disliked. He's, you know, he has the reputation as being one of the worst governors in New Jersey history. And it, now, if you know anything about New Jersey history, that's no mean feat, be considered one of the worst. But what happens is his enemies, in a very 21st century sort of way, they start spreading these rumors that he is not just kind of helping himself to the treasury and that he's an inept politician, that, you know, everything he touches falls apart, but that he's got some weird personal habits as well, including dressing up like women. And there's a famous portrait that still exists, that is in the New York Historical Society in Manhattan, and you can go there today. I'm not sure if they're open again, but probably soon. And it's a big, full-scale, you know, one of those great sort of 18th century oil paintings of what at first looks like a woman in a kind of period outfit. And you look at it, and you say, well, it's sort of a mannish looking woman. And then you realize it is a man. It's a man in women's clothes. And it was held up that this was a portrait of Lord Cornbury. And this was done to try to undermine, to destroy his reputation. We now know that the painting isn't of Lord Cornbury. We're not really sure who the painting is of, actually. But it's still in the New York Historical Society. Got a special plaque next to it that sort of explains this is not what we used to think it was. When he becomes, his connection to all this is when he becomes governor, he's assigned a boatload of counselors, local counselors. Sort of movers and shakers, local guys, to kind of advise him on how to treat the locals, as it were. And one of them is Daniel Eads. Along with all the occult stuff, he will kind of get labeled, well, he's close to Cornbury, therefore he must too also be corrupt. So he's for the empire. The other thing we have to keep in the back of our minds here is that this is the time in American history, 1720s, 1730s, where the idea of independence is just starting to kind of percolate. It's not going to break wide open just yet. There's still time before that happens. But this is the period at which that kind of seed first starts to grow. And so along with everything else, Daniel leads to his enemies. You can say, well, he's against America, he's for the empire, so that's just one more strike against him.
Now, I think we've been building up to the part that a lot of my listeners wanted to hear about, and that's Benjamin Franklin, who comes into this story.
Monster, man.
What's that?
When are we going to get to the monster, man?
Well, we do have to get to the monster, but Benjamin Franklin, I love talking Ben Franklin because, you know, he just seems very modern in a way. He seems like a party sure. animal type guy.
Sure.
I first learned about that through the rumors that he was part of the Hellfire Club, which I don't know if that's confirmed, but he was sort of a prankster. How does he come into this story?
Yeah, he's of all the founding fathers, if I could somehow, you know, magically make, you know, meet one of the founding fathers, I'd want to meet Franklin. He seems like the most fun, you know, he loved to drink, he loved to eat, he loved a good meal. There wasn't a woman that he encountered whose ass he wouldn't grab, you know, very politically incorrect by today's standards, you know, but he was incredibly sharp and smart and astute. And, you know, if you invited him to a party, he would be the first guy up on the table with the lampshade on his head, you know, say, I love you guys, you know, drunk and slapping everybody on the back and laughing and having a good time. But he shows up, born in Boston, he comes to Philadelphia, and he wants to be a printer. He is a printer. And like many printers before him, what's the easiest way to start making money as a printer in these days? Produce an almanac. They don't cost that much to make, and you can sell them relatively inexpensively, and people want to read them. You know, there's a market for it, and so he creates, of course, famously, Poor Richard's Almanac, And the thing for Franklin is that in the area, the big competing, or the not competing yet, but the almanac to beat is the Leeds Almanac. That's the one everybody reads. That's the one that, you know, you can buy down at the local corner paper store. There aren't any newspapers yet, but if there was such a thing as a corner paper store back then, you could buy the Leeds Almanac there. And so in the very first issue of Poor Richard, Franklin attacks the Leeds family. And he does it purely out of a promotional gimmick. Doesn't really have anything against the Leeds family. He just wants to create controversy so people will read his almanac. And he starts saying things that, the Leeds family, they're into the occult. And by now, by the time Franklin comes along, Daniel Leeds has retired. And his son, one of his many sons, Titan Leeds, takes over, and he's going to run the almanac. And both Franklin and Titan Leeds know each other. And so he starts saying things like Titan Leeds, in the guise of Richard Saunders, as in Poor Richard, Franklin says, you know, I've done the astrological charts. I've done the alchemical investigations, and I have figured out that Titan Leeds is going to die in 1733. And he publishes it, because why not? There's nothing that says you can't. And so Leeds sees this, and obviously he's not dead. And Titan Leeds gets very upset by it. He takes it really personally. And he starts publishing in his almanac that this Franklin guy is an upstart. He's a liar. And Franklin doesn't miss a beat. He doesn't react. He just says, well, I don't know who this person saying all these horrible things about me is, but I know my friend Titan Leeds would never say scurrilous things about me. So it must be the ghost of Titan Leeds. He really is dead, and he's come back as a sorcerer to haunt me. And Franklin is saying all this with a straight face, I'm sure laughing his ass off behind that. But every time he says something, Leeds reacts in a very upset and serious way. And that just allows Franklin to, jump on the abuse bandwagon and keep saying wacky stuff. And it works. The Leeds Almanac goes into decline, and the Poor Richard's Almanac becomes, now world famous. I mean, if you ask people, what's the most famous almanac in American history? They'll probably say Poor Richard's Almanac, published by Ben Franklin. When in fact he was a rival of to the Leeds family, and the Leeds family kind of goes out of business because of Franklin.
And just to note for my listeners, Titan Leeds himself is an interesting character. He's a polymath, very smart, bright, and I think Franklin may have another sort of motive in playing this little game, in that he really wants to sort of embarrass and undermine the people who believe in astrology, right?
Sure, yes. Franklin, in this thing about saying that Leeds is dead, he basically plagiarizes that from a series of almanac wars that had been going on back in England and in the continent. And so he just took that model and brought it to North America. And so what do? You say, it's like today. What's the worst thing you can say about a political opponent? He's a socialist. And so to accuse somebody of the occult back then, if somebody accused a political rival today of being, an occultist, it wouldn't resonate that much unless you're one of these really deep QAnon types.
I was going to say like the Pizzagate types.
Sure. That's sort of an extreme version of it. And so, that was an easy way to besmirch a rival. And just like now, when people believe crazy crap without hesitation, without, thinking about it, the same thing went on back then. And so if it's in this almanac, if it says that Titan Leeds is dead and he's come back as a sorcerer, it must be real.
So, it sounds like Ben Franklin was doing some fake news before fake news was the thing.
Yeah, he basically invents it. I mean, well, He's the first one to really employ it extensively here in North America. It's already been going on back in England and in Western Europe. But he sort of, again, he sees, here's a model I can use, and he brings it over here and he employs it to great effect.
Yeah, it's really interesting, not to go off topic, but I think people often forget, if you look back into this period of history, there's a lot of like conspiracy theories and panics that are occurring.
Oh, sure, sure.
There was an Illuminati panic in New England at one point. There were conspiracy theories that anti-Catholics were pushing after the assassination of Lincoln, claiming the Vatican did it. I mean, this was, you know, the fake news era.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, anything old is new again. We do not have a lock on this. This stuff has been around a long time.
So I guess that gets us into, how exactly does the sort of Leeds Devil turn into the Jersey Devil in this like winged camel-headed monster?
Yeah, it takes a while. It's a very sort of slow evolution over the course of the 18th and 19th century. What happens is, and Dr. Esposito and I were, one of the things we were always sort of disappointed with in our book was that, as hard as we tried, we couldn't quite, because, you know, historians, we're always looking for a text. We're always looking for a letter or a diary or a printed something, you know, or a manuscript that connects things along. And we had some trouble finding, in the interim period from, like, say, the Revolution to the antebellum period, the story of the Leeds Devil kind of goes a little, it's on the verge of extinction. It's not really well known by people. It's lost almost all of its connection to the actual Leeds family. You know, Daniel Leeds, Titan Leeds, Ben Franklin, that whole phase of the story is largely forgotten. And it's only by, say, the 1840s, 1850s, right before the Civil War, that you start seeing little sort of scraps of evidence where people believe in this Leeds Devil thing. And now this is the point at which it's starting to get kind of connected to a monster, to a beast somehow that is wandering around the Pine Barrens. Again, not really widely known outside the Pine Barrens. It mostly gets out of the Pine Barrens by reporters out of Philadelphia and New York going to do sort of biographies on the Pineys, as they were called, which is a derogatory term, of people who live in the Pine Barrens. This is a population of people who gain this really sort of dark reputation as kind of living in huts and hovels deep in the forest and, you know, surviving by crime and all sorts of terrible things. They're secretive. Don't go near them or they'll eat you. This kind of reputation of horrible, terrible people, cannibals almost, living in the woods of New Jersey.
Like the movie Deliverance or something.
kind of. In the derogatory way, some people tend to think of rural people in places in the South or in Appalachia. That kind of thing is something which is also leveled against people who live in the Pine Barrens. We tend not to think of it that way because you think New Jersey, that sort of environment doesn't exist there because New Jersey is just one big city, one big, you know, horrible, disgusting, crappy, dirty city. But, you know, that's where this sort of thing is starting off. And so it kind of percolates along. By the end of the 19th century, you start to find more published accounts of people claiming they saw some kind of monster in the woods, the Leeds Devil. And so by the end of the 19th century, all that political stuff is now gone. All that connection has been severed completely. It's been the Leeds Devil, the idea of the Leeds Devil has been completely detached from the original facts and evidence from where it starts. And then into the early 20th century, you have a couple of incidents take place in and around Mount Holly, around Burlington, out by Atlantic City, out by the Jersey Shore, of strange footprints in the snow and all this kind of thing. and some reporters write little blurbs about it, and they use the expression Leeds Devil. And at the time in Philadelphia, there is basically a static amusement park called the 9th and Arch Street Dime Museum. Dime museums were really popular in the 19th century. These were places where you went in, and it was kind of like a circus sideshow, but in a building. It didn't move around. And you'd pay 10 cents, hence the name Dime Museum. And, you know, they would use the term museum to kind of give it a sort of gloss of scholarliness, but it was really just sensationalism. Two-headed babies in jars and sword swallowers and the fat man and the skinny, or the fat lady and the skinny man and all that kind of stuff.
P.T. Barnum's Fiji Mermaid.
I'm sorry?
I said P.T. Barnum's Fiji Mermaid, things like that.
P.T. Barnum comes out of the dime museum tradition. What Barnum does is basically take that idea and make it even bigger. And so they are looking, the guys who run the 9th and Arch Street, they're looking for, they're always looking for something new. Just like today, you know, you can't do the same thing over and over again. People get bored with it. And they see these newspaper accounts of the Leeds Devil, and they just think jackpot. And so they start to create this mythology of a monster. But to them, the name Leeds Devil doesn't quite sing. And so they think about it, and they say, got it. Jersey Devil. And they're all sitting around thinking, genius. And so they start spreading these ideas of the Jersey Devil. They claim they have caught one. They send out what may very well have been the first monster hunt in American history. All of it's staged to make it look like they're finding something. They even have an old circus cart, you know, one of those old-timey circus cage things on the wheels. They put a big tarp over it so you can't see what's inside. And they tell everybody they've caught the Jersey Devil. And the crowd starts showing up, and they start making lots of money off of this. And that's where the modern conception of the Jersey Devil as this kind of winged monster in the woods really starts.
Would it be okay? Could I keep you a few minutes over? I wanted to ask a few more questions.
Sure.
That's where the sort of Jersey Devil myth really comes from. Do we have any, can you fill in the blanks on some of the aspects of the myth and where we may get these aspects? For instance, do we have other examples of, someone being portrayed as like an evil figure, like Daniel Leeds, someone being portrayed as, Satan's harbinger, later on turning into a monster? I think you mentioned this is not necessarily the same, but Jack the Ripper sort of becomes a mythical supernatural monster in different forms later on.
The Jersey Devil does not exist in a vacuum. It's one of actually a number of sort of wacky, ghosty, monstery, apparition-y sort of things that are running around now the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. There's Jack the Kisser, Jack the Stone Thrower, Spring-Heeled Jack. There's a Spring-Heeled Jack in England. Suddenly Spring-Heeled Jack shows up in America. And so there are a number of these kind of somewhat similar notions of sort of ghostly, monstery creatures running around doing weird stuff. So when people start talking about the Jersey Devil, and you start getting these newspaper accounts, people sort of believe it because there's already a kind of environment in which people believe this sort of thing can happen.
I was going to say, too, going back to Ben Franklin, people like Ben Franklin at the time thought that in these unexplored, uncharted territories of the U.S., there may be all these mysterious creatures or monsters that we don't know about.
Yeah, sure. We forget that when Europeans first start coming to North America, there's already several hundred million native people who live here. They don't need to be discovered. Who discovered America? The native people discovered America. Columbus didn't discover America. The native people did. They were here a long time before Europeans came along. But the native people had a whole pantheon if I can use the Greek term, of monsters, of forest spirits, you know, a rich and complex theology about, they were polytheists, and they believed in different kinds of gods and spirits running around. And so when Europeans come here and they begin to encounter the native people, Europeans bring over monster stories themselves. You know, England, Western Europe, you know, all, basically all throughout the old world is full of monsters and spiritual creatures. And so when these early settlers come here, they bring these ideas with them. They bring these beliefs with them. They don't suddenly stop believing in monsters because they show up here. In fact, it kind of goes into overdrive. And so what part of how this Jersey Devil story comes along, we argued, is where you get this kind of mashup between Native American legends and ideas brought over by Europeans from the old country, and they kind of morph into new stories, new legends, new creatures. But there's tons of them running all over the place.
And I guess the other loose end here is, you know, I get Daniel Leeds and how, you know, the Leeds Devil myth starts and then that turns into the Jersey Devil. But what about Mother Leeds? I mean, where does is there any evidence we have circumstantially of maybe how this witch character comes into the picture?
Yeah, well, she's the, you know, there's really three characters in the story. There's Daniel Leeds, Mother Leeds, and the Jersey Devil itself. Daniel Leeds was a real person, although he gets turned into a kind of fictive creature himself. The real Daniel Leeds is totally forgotten about. Mother Leeds is a totally made-up character. And then, of course, the Leeds Devil, the Jersey Devil itself. And so we went looking for this, you know, is there something out there? Is there a belief system out there? Is there maybe a person out there or a couple of people out there who served as a kind of model for Mother Leeds? And the closest we could come to was a woman named Anne Hutchinson. And she was a real person. She was a Puritan who lived in Boston, extremely important figure in colonial American history and in colonial America women's history. They didn't use this term back then, but she's considered an early feminist. She believed that women should be able to preach, that women should have equality with men. All the same stuff that got the Puritan elders angry that gets conservative men angry today. You know, we don't like pushy women. Women are meant to stay in the background. And she gets run out of Boston. And she converts to being a Quaker because the Quakers treat her decently where the Puritans will not. And she has lots of kids. And her final child, or 13th child, maybe, we're not sure exactly, the myth says it's 13, there's a technical medical term for it, but I can't think of it offhand. But it's sort of, I'm not even sure if stillborn is the right word, because I'm not sure if it's alive or not. But it was basically a large blob of sort of flesh and blood and maybe some hair and some teeth. It probably would have been pretty, for people back then to see, pretty horrifying. I mean, it'd be horrifying to see this today. But what happens is, because she's a kind of political rabble rouser, the Puritan hierarchy in Boston, the preachers start saying, you see, this is what happens. This is God's curse upon Anne Hutchinson, because she refused to know her place. She refused to behave like a proper woman, and God punished her by giving her this monstrous birth. And so this was a very well-known story. It's many years after Daniel Leeds, but we think a reasonable explanation here is that once the legend of the Leeds Devil / Jersey Devil begins to sort of grow a little bit, that the story of Anne Hutchinson kind of gets attached to it, and that's how you get the creation of this Mother Leeds character.
And how does the Jersey Devil turn into this? I guess in the book you say, how does the Jersey Devil go from obscure monster to a star? And would the 1909 panic be the start of that?
Yeah, that's basically where it is. The guys running the Knife and Art Street Museum they've got people all hyped up about this and they want to come see it, but you got to have something to show them. And so one of the strangest aspects to the whole story is they somehow find a kangaroo. There's a guy up in New York who runs a sort of animal renting business. And God knows how this guy got one, but he's got a kangaroo. And so the guys at the museum, they contact the guy in Albany. They rent the kangaroo. The kangaroo gets brought down to Philadelphia clandestinely. And they put little cardboard wings on him and they paint him green. And they put him up on a stage. And that's what they're going to show to people. So people come walking in and look at the Jersey Devil. And they have a kid on stage hiding in the wings with a long stick with a nail on it. And you can probably see where this is going to be going. And when they bring in a group of rubes, the kid, everything's in shadow and dark. The kid stabs the poor kangaroo with the nail. The kangaroo, of course, starts going crazy and jumping around and screaming. And that scares the crowd. And before anybody can figure out what's going on, they usher them out. And then they bring in the next crowd of people. And they do this for some weeks until people finally start to realize, that looks like a kangaroo that you painted green. I don't think that's real. And so the whole story sort of breaks and everybody has a good laugh about it. But the genie's out of the bottle. The monster's out of the cupboard, if you will. The monster's gotten out of the chimney. And people start saying, they might have faked this, but I actually saw this. The Jersey Devil's real. And it just goes from there. And next thing you know, in 2019, 2020, people are still coming up with video footage and supposed photographs of the Jersey Devil.
Now, wrapping up here, it's interesting when you talk about any of these things, whether it's the Jersey Devil or, the example I'll use is, I was saying to someone recently that, Ancient Aliens, that TV show, that Chariot of the Gods stuff is really like racialist. Right? It's racist when you underneath the surface. Yeah. And someone said to me, they said, people just want to enjoy the show. They don't actually necessarily believe it, JG. And I said, well, that's fine. But like, why can't we talk about maybe the underlying things within these myths? I don't care if people want to watch the TV show, but I should be able to discuss maybe what is behind these myths. I think that's just as interesting. How would you respond to people that are saying, oh, you're taking the fun out of the Jersey Devil?
Well, as I like to say, it's all fun and games until the historian shows up. But no, the whole ancient alien concept, it is racist. It is, people of color, brown-skinned people could not possibly have figured out how to build the pyramids. They could not possibly have figured out how to do this thing or that thing. It must have been, lost white races. It must have been aliens from another planet because these brown-skinned people are too dumb to be able to figure this out. The native people could not have built the cities, the stone cities of the Ohio River Valley or the Mississippi River Valley. It had to have been Templars somehow managed to come here. Templars or the ancient Hebrews somehow managed to drag the Ark of the Covenant out of Canaan and get it to America. It's anti-history, it's anti-facts and evidence. It's a blight on our historical knowledge because, when I watched In Search Of, I was fascinated by it, and it led me to want to study this material more. But Leonard Nimoy and the makers of In Search Of, some of whom were Christian fundamentalists, they try to at least have a kind of scholarly air to what they were doing, and they really tried to keep the outrageousness to a minimum. Unlike what goes on today, where they really, it seems to me, they have no cap on the outrageousness. In fact, the more outrageous, the better. It doesn't matter that the guys have been tearing apart Oak Island for 10 years now and haven't found anything. We'll still tune into it. It doesn't matter that none of this supposed evidence for ancient aliens is actually evidence of ancient aliens. You know, the thing that drives me crazy and my colleagues, I know a lot of historians, I know a lot of archaeologists who this just makes us nuts, is that the real history behind this, the real archaeology, is so fascinating. It's so interesting. Why make up stuff when you have, you know, the reality here? And, you know, there isn't, you know, I've been on a few of these TV shows and, you know, I'm going to be filming one in a couple of days. And, you know, you try to convince the producers, you know, that if we tried this thing over here, no one's ever done this before. You could break open a whole new way of looking at this. A few years ago, I was on a series called, now I forget what the name of it was. Mysterious Beasts. It was for, I don't know, the Learning Channel, one of them, I forget. They're going to hate me now. I can't remember the name of it. But it was about classic monsters in classical mythology. And I appeared in it, and they somehow managed to buy a hall at the New York Comic Con in 2018. And they said, we're going to do a panel. It's going to help break out the show, and we're going to, you know, show commercials for the show. And there'll be me and two other people who appeared in it, and we'll be on a panel. We'll talk, and you know, it'll be fun. And so sure, Comic Con, of course. So we did it, and it was a lot of fun, and you know, a packed audience, and we were across the hall from the Harry Potter panel, and I thought, oh, there's no way people are going to come in and look at this when they got Harry Potter right across the hallway. But we had a packed house, so it went really well. And it was over. Everybody's leaving, and one of the Science Channel producers comes over to me and says, you know, dude, thanks a lot. It will look great. For those of you who want to see this, who haven't seen it, if you just go to my website, it's on the whole lecture's on the website, my website. But the guy came up to me and he says, you know, we really appreciate you coming out and doing this, you know. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm going to take a shot. This is my only chance I'm going to get to talk to this guy. I'm going to make my, you know, my elevator pitch, as they call it. And I said, consider this. Let's do a series about monsters, right? But let's do a series where we look at the history of monsters as a way to examine the history of human hatred and fear, of religious bigotry, of racial bigotry, and use monsters. And we can do this with Bigfoot, we can do it with the Jersey Devil, we can do it with the Minotaur, you know, there's all these, the Skeepodii and werewolves, and you know, you name it, we got a whole shelf full of figurines that we can use to explore this. What I think is an important idea that we could maybe actually teach people something, you entertain, but also get people thinking about important questions. And the guy looks at me and he says, you know, that's the best explanation for monster show I've ever heard. I would love to do it. Now in my head, you know, because in your head's going like a zillion miles a second. I'm thinking, oh my God, I did it. He's going to do it. You know, in that split second of timing. And he says, but no channel, no network will ever air it.
Wow.
So there's some frustration for you.
So in that regard too, I just wanted to mention that, you know, I think something could be said about, you know, if you're willing to believe in monsters, that it could be a pipeline to other things. You don't want to believe in evidence for that. Then maybe you'll start believing in other maybe kooky things like anti-vaxxerism and whatnot. And I do think at times there is a connection. On the other hand, you know, I used to be a really hardcore like new atheist, and I would be like, there is no God, whatnot, that type of kid. And you know, an older lady just said to me once, you know, I just want to believe in something because I'm old and for when I pass away. And I sort of stopped and I said, who am I to take that away from her? Is it really so bad if people believe in a Jersey Devil, just for me to play devil's advocate, so to speak?
Well, it's not an unreasonable question. And, you know, on the broad spectrum of things, people who believe in Bigfoot, people who believe in the Jersey Devil, they tend to be, from my experience, they tend to be at that end of the scale, which, you know, if you believe in the Jersey Devil, it probably is not going to lead you to burning a cross on somebody's lawn. You know, he said, fingers crossed. But then you head up that other end of the scale where not so much, where you start running into the anti-vaxxers and the anti-maskers. And, you know, just when you thought anti-vaccinationists were the biggest dimwits on the planet, along come the anti-maskers. But there is, on that scale, there is, and, you know, and this goes for UFO stuff as well. And that doesn't mean every person who believes in UFOs suddenly is a closet Nazi. But there is that end of the scale, which does lead some people into much more extremist thought than, you know, yeah, sure. If you want to believe in the Jersey Devil, God bless you. Go ahead. You know, people come up to me, you know, I give lectures on this stuff all the time, and people are always coming up to me and saying, you know, should I go into, you know, is it wrong to go looking for the Jersey Devil? I say, well, no, not really. You're not going to find the monster you're looking for. But if you find out something about how forests grow, if you find out something about ecology and the way that climate change is killing off the forests, if you learn that while looking for Bigfoot, if you learn that by looking for the Firebird, if you learn that by looking for the Jersey Devil, then it's a win-win situation. The history of science is full of stories of people studying weird stuff, non-mainstream stuff, who discover important knowledge that becomes part of mainstream science. I mean, zoology, biology, ornithology, these are fields that all began back in the ancient world by people looking at monsters. And so there is an upside to it. You know, and I too get people, you know, when I give a lecture on this, some 80-year-old lady will come up to me and say, you know, young man, wonderful, thank you for coming, but I know the Jersey Devil is real because I saw him in my yard. And what am I going to do? Intellectually bludgeon an 80-year-old lady? I just say, oh, that's great. Oh, nice. Thank you for coming, you know, and you just go. But yeah, there's a whole spectrum of this. And you do have an extreme end to it that does lead to violence, and it does lead to racial hatred and religious bigotry, and all the darkest aspects of the human condition. So, you know, as long as you stay down at that sort of calm end, you're okay.
You know, that's the note I wanted to end on too. I was going to ask, and I think you already answered it, was, you know, despite your writing books about, oh, there isn't a Sasquatch, you know, or, oh, there isn't really a Jersey Devil, but there is this other interesting story. I've heard you often say you aren't Mr. Anti-Cryptozoology. You aren't Mr. Anti-Monster.
You know, again, you know, if you want to go out in the woods looking for a monster, you know, be my guest. Go ahead. I don't think you're going to find what you're looking for. But again, if you find something, if you learn something, you know, people will come up to me and say, my kid is really interested in what should I tell them to do? I said, get them to start reading history, start reading science, start reading biology. You know, when I was a kid, in 1973, I went to the local public library and I asked the librarian, do you have any books on monsters? And she led me to this book by James B. Sweeney, called A Pictorial History of Sea Monsters and Other Dangerous Marine Life. Fantastic book, lots of pictures in it. And I was transformed by this because it seemed like here's a really smart guy. He's like a scholar who's talking about this stuff. And I could sit for hours on the floor in the corner of the library reading this. And it sort of helped. It made me want to read more about science. It made me want to read more about history. And so if cryptozoology, even ghost hunting, if it can act as a kind of gateway to wider knowledge, wider understanding of the cosmos, then I'm all for it. And who knows, somebody might drag in a Sasquatch carcass. You know, if that happens, I'll be the first one to say, well, son of a bitch, it's real, you know. Sure.
I guess what I would say to that, beyond thank you for coming on the show and providing such a great talk about the Jersey Devil, is, you know, in a way, I think cryptozoologists and skeptics alike both have something in common in the sense that they do want to have a sense of wonder. And sure. I think that's a great thing. I want to thank you again for coming on the program. How can my listeners pleasure. Keep up with your work and maybe purchase the Jersey Devil book?
Yeah, if you just Google my name, you'll get my Kane University webpage. And you can read just tons of stuff there, op-eds, articles. You can see my books. And you know, if you have questions, email me. This is what I do for a living. I'm a public scholar at a public university. I'm the associate professor for the history of science, technology, and medicine at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. And that's what I get paid to do.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed this Devil's Night edition of the program and found my conversation with Brian Regal, co-author with Frank J. Esposito of The Secret History of the Jersey Devil, how Quakers, Hucksters, and Benjamin Franklin created a monster to be as fascinating as I did. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of the program by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Emilia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, Mickey, and Chase. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then join those listeners in supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. $10 and $15 tier supporters get a producer's credit again on each and every edition of the program. So consider supporting me on patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, that make this show possible. And with that being said,